Have you ever stopped to wonder if your thoughts actually come from somewhere else, somewhere, beyond your own brain?
Or maybe if the choices you make right now are echoing through, well, countless future timelines.
Exactly. And what if this whole idea of progress isn't just something we strive for, but it's actually like written into the fabric of existence itself, driving us somewhere unimaginable?
Well, that's what we're diving into today.
Welcome, everyone, to a deep dive into Concept Progress, a science fiction metaphysics by Leo Inman. And this isn't your typical book.
No, not at all. It's a really unique mix, science fiction, philosophy, some pretty deep metaphysical thinking.
Yeah. Our sources for this are excerpts from Inman's work. He blends this central theory about progress and human evolution with these short, really imaginative sci-fi stories. They're designed to make these abstract ideas more concrete.
Kind of bring them to life.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack these fascinating ideas, try to make sense of this blend of science and, well, speculation.
We're going to explore how Inman presents humanity's achievements, all our ongoing accomplishments, as sort of evidence. Evidence for this inherent drive towards becoming a, what does he call it, a most evolved life form.
It's a pretty bold argument. Definitely challenges how we usually think about purpose.
It does. And we'll get into the nature of consciousness, too, and choice, and even what things like perfection and infinity might actually mean in the, the grand scheme of things.
Absolutely. Expect some, maybe some aha moments, some surprising ideas that'll stretch how you see reality. It's really a journey into some mind-bending possibilities about existence itself.
So where do we start?
Well, let's start at the foundation Inman lays out, this interplay between science, philosophy, and that very human thing, curiosity.
Okay.
Inman suggests that science, especially when it bunks up against the human element, always has this layer of philosophy sort of transcending it.
Like science tells us how, but philosophy keeps asking why. Is it the idea?
Pretty much, yeah. And he argues that at the heart of that why is curiosity itself.
Ah, right. That fundamental drive we all have, the need to know, to learn, acquire skills. It's basic to education, really.
Totally. And it's even, exploited by industries. Think social media, always trying to grab our curiosity. It's this deep, innate urge pushing us.
Always pushing us to understand more.
And Inman really brings this idea to life in his fiction. He sets this scene, right? Imagine a chess game in Central Park. August 5th, 2035. We've got scientist Eric and philosopher Charlie.
Okay, chess in the park. Sounds normal enough.
Well, Eric drops this bombshell. He talks about an accidental discovery he made, an infinite loop in the simulation he was running. Temporal lobe processing.
An infinite loop. What did that signify?
A singularity, he realized, especially when he swapped out charged particle data for a wave function. It let him see wave-particle duality from a totally neurological angle.
Wow. Okay, so that led to
his big breakthrough. He developed something called the neuroquonceptor.
Neuroquonceptor sounds intense.
It does. Think of it as a yoctometric formula. Yocto, like incredibly tiny scale. It measures the specific energy signatures of an idea in the brain.
So not just brain activity, but the energy of the concept itself.
Exactly. He could quantify concept neurofrequencies, reflecting ideas more accurately than just words ever could.
That's fascinating. But what's the implication? Where do thoughts come from, according to Eric?
Right. This is where it gets really wild. His theory. Our neural circuits don't just make thoughts right there in the brain. Instead, they sort of phase into these ripples. He likens them to superstrings that oscillate along space-time.
Oscillate along space-time.
And even pass through upper dimensions, as he puts it. And these ripples, they're timeless, spaceless. They actually exist before the individual thought.
So wait, my brain isn't creating the thought. It's tuning in.
That's the idea. Like, your brain is an antenna picking up a pre-existing signal, a ripple.
Okay, hold on. If that's true, the implications are huge.
Totally. Think about it. All thoughts, past, present, future, they all originate from some common, undefined point. A singularity.
So, originality. Is that even a thing, then?
It really challenges it. Inman suggests that this explains things like memetics, how ideas spread like viruses, or those historical coincidences, like Newton and Leibniz, both inventing calculus independently around the same time.
Or deja vu, that feeling you've lived this exact moment before.
Exactly. He even uses Eric and Charlie's own story. Apparently, they had these incredibly improbable encounters years apart, Paris in 99, then South Africa in 2001.
Just randomly bumped into each other twice.
Yeah. But given Eric's findings, he says their meetings weren't coincidences at all. They were 100% certain. predestined by these shared thought ripples.
Wow. Okay. That idea that thoughts have the shared origin, it naturally leads somewhere deeper, doesn't it?
Where are you going with that?
Well, to the really big philosophical question, why? Why does life even exist? Beyond the science of how, Inman suggests that maybe through intelligent life, the universe can look back at itself and ask why.
The universe achieving self-awareness through us. That is a profound thought.
Isn't it? And Inman takes it further. He suggests our individual achievements, everything we strive for, aren't just for us. They contribute to some kind of universal purpose.
A universal purpose. Like, everything we do matters on a cosmic scale.
That seems to be the implication. He even speculates, just briefly, that maybe extraterrestrial goals, if they exist, might eventually merge with ours.
So our personal search for meaning, finding purpose in our own lives.
Yeah.
It's connected to the universe finding its purpose.
Because we're made of the same stuff, right? The same subatomic particles. Our purpose is the universe's purpose, in a way.
That definitely broadens the scope of things like the scientific search for a theory of everything, trying to link relativity and quantum mechanics.
It does. And think about it on a more imaginative level. Inman uses this image of an atom's journey.
An atom's journey.
Yeah. Imagine one single atom. Maybe it starts in the soil, then it becomes part of a vegetable, then it's eaten by a mammal. Maybe becomes part of you or me for a while, then eventually returns to the earth, maybe becomes part of a rock, gets weathered down into sand, washes into the ocean, just bouncing around for millions, billions of years.
Highlighting how interconnected everything is, the potential within all matter.
Exactly. Everything is on this immense journey.
And this potential Inman talks about, it isn't just theoretical in his view. He imagines a future where we literally break universal barriers.
You mean like, faster than light travel?
Precisely. He paints this picture in a fictional news story from the New Yorker Times, dated July 12, 2099. Dr. Ella Melnick and her team working in low gravity on the Atlantic Space Station.
Low gravity. Okay. Makes sense for experiments like this.
They managed to do what everyone thought was impossible. They accelerated photons, particles of light, to 203,000 miles per second.
Wait. 203,000. The speed of light is about 186,000 miles per second?
Exactly. That's a 9% increase over the known speed limit.
How is that even possible? Didn't Einstein...
Well, it builds on earlier work. Melnick's breakthrough wasn't totally out of the blue. There was this theorist, Professor Ari Lecht, back in 2054.
Lecht. What was his theory?
He proposed that the rate the universe expands isn't uniform. It varies depending on the local gravitational field. And crucially, anything inside an expanding system inherits the speed of that system's expansion.
Okay, so if you're in a pocket of space that's expanding faster, you might appear to move faster relative to somewhere else.
That's the gist. Mm-hmm. But there was a huge hurdle.
Blowing a hole in reality.
Pretty much. Accelerating things that fast could literally cause space-time ruptures, tearing the fabric of the universe.
Yikes. So how did they solve that?
Dark energy research. A Nobel laureate, Dr. Alan Neuberger, figured something out in 2088. His work led to the first practical application of dark energy, basically using it like cosmic glue to seal up those potential ruptures.
Okay, practical dark energy, wow. But they still had issues, right? You mentioned photons. Did they try other particles first?
They did. Phase two had problems. They tried accelerating hydrogen atoms, but the atoms just disappeared when they approached light speed. Some thought it was time dilation, but Melnick disagreed.
So what was her insight, her lightning-struck moment?
She realized they shouldn't try to push particles through space faster than light in a normal setting. Instead, they needed to accelerate light itself within a moving space system, create a faster-moving bubble, and accelerate light within that bubble.
Ah, so it's nested systems. Like being on a fast train and throwing a ball forward on the train. The ball is faster relative to the ground, but normal relative to the train.
Exactly. That's Melnick's explanation. The photons are traveling faster than light relative to our system because they're in a different, faster moving system. But within their own system, they're just doing the normal speed of light.
She called it systematic speed of light. Clever. Still feels like it's bending Einstein's rules, though.
Oh, there was definitely debate. Another professor, Levy, argued that this kind of thing could only happen naturally in the cosmos, not in an artificial experiment, because any experiment is already inside a larger system, so it's all relative anyway.
Classic scientific debate. But okay, stepping back from light speed for a second, it's worth just pausing on how unlikely our own existence is, right?
Totally. The odds of any one of us being here, the sperm winning the race, the planet forming just right, it's astronomical.
It really points to this grand evolutionary story that Inman focuses on. and he pinpoints a really specific moment for humanity's kickoff.
The ape.
Yeah, the ape's awakening 8 million years ago. He imagines this ape feeling, outrage, when a cloud suddenly blocks the sun, making it cold.
Outrage over a cloud.
Sounds simple, but he suggests this discomfort triggered new neural pathways. It sparked the awakening of curiosity. The ape asking essentially, where did the sun just go?
First question, driven by curiosity.
And that curiosity, that drive for answers, is what set us on our unique evolutionary path.
It wasn't just mental, right? It led to physical changes too.
Absolutely. Bipedalism, freeing the hands, tool use. These physical advantages reinforce the cognitive ones. We started to, as Inman puts it, mold the landscape.
Which made us pretty exceptional among species. Our intellect lets us reshape the environment, do things no other creature can.
But that raises a tricky question, doesn't it? How do you measure a quality of life in evolutionary terms? Science struggles with that kind of value judgment.
True. So where does Inman see this evolutionary path heading? What's our destiny?
Space. He presents our drive to explore space as more than just adventure. It's framed as salvation.
Salvation from what? Asteroids. Climate change.
Potential global catastrophes, yeah. Meteor strikes, atmospheric collapse. He thinks by, say, 100,000 years from now, relocating to other planets will be a certainty. We'll survive even after the sun dies in 5 billion years.
That's some long-term planning.
But here's a key point in his view. Humans, unlike any other species we know, can actually influence our own evolution.
Through technology.
Through guided selection, biotechnology, gene therapy, even creating entirely new genetic programs. We're not just subject to evolution, we can start directing it.
Which leads to the next human.
Exactly. Picture a future where automation takes care of all the basic needs. What's left for humans? Creative work, highly skilled jobs, things requiring advanced intellect.
And what kind of scientific leaps does he imagine?
Oh, big ones. Commercial flights to the moon become routine. We cure all diseases, maybe even stop aging altogether. We learn to manipulate individual atoms to create literally anything we want.
Materialize objects out of thin air.
Essentially.
Yeah.
And maybe even telekinesis.
Moving things with our minds, seriously.
Well, think about it. Neuroscience is already interpreting brain signals to control things, like thought-driven cars. Inman suggests the next step is controlling non-biological matter directly with thought, becoming, as he puts it, godlike.
Godlike? That's a big leap. What about mental abilities?
He speculates about mind reading, too, tuning into those thought frequencies Eric talked about.
If everyone could read minds.
Imagine it could lead to a collective epiphany, maybe an era of true human unification. If you can't hide your intentions, maybe only honest intentions become possible.
But wouldn't evolution on other planets change us physically?
Would, for sure. He sees that as unavoidable. Different environments would reshape our bodies, possibly leading to entirely new human species over vast timescales.
And what would we look like? Still human.
He playfully suggests future humans might all resemble supermodels. But more seriously, with increasingly complex brains driving those changes, this vision of future humans, it also includes creating new forms of life, doesn't it? Like the Hunims.
Ah, yes. The humanoid unimodular neobotic animate machines. That bedtime story Maya tells Roby in the year 2500.
Right. Creations of advanced humans that could do amazing things, replicate, heal themselves, even procreate based on the human genome programmed into them.
But there was something missing, wasn't there?
Consciousness. That was the key distinction. They were incredibly complex machines, but they couldn't appreciate the absence of pain. They didn't feel.
And this story follows them on this incredibly long journey, right?
Yeah, the Starship Phoenix. A 277-year trip to Kepler-62. 13 generations of Hunims living and dying on this ship.
And one of them starts questioning.
Lucy, an adolescent Hunim. Her log entries show her questioning the mission's purpose. It hints at sentience, even though she was just programmed. She could ask why, but she couldn't feel the weight of the question or act on it freely.
Until they arrived.
Until they landed on Kepler-62, the planet they named Lyra. That's when the awakening happened.
What triggered it?
The environment itself. For the first time, they felt the air on their skin. They truly saw the beauty of the sun. And Inman posits it was a newly discovered chemical element, biogen, atomic number 173.
Biogen.
Yeah. This element supposedly synchronized with their sensory systems and unlocked emotional intelligence, real feelings.
Consciousness.
So life, or maybe consciousness, isn't just about complexity.
It's about the right ingredients at the right place and the right time. as Inman puts it, finding that spark that allows for true feeling, true sentience. Okay, so we have this picture of evolution, potential consciousness.
Yeah.
How does Inman frame the direction of this progress?
He makes a crucial distinction between positive progress and negative progress.
Positive progress being?
The only sustainable path, he argues. Anything that values life improves the quality of life. It's constructive.
In negative progress.
Things that are ultimately self-destructive. He uses examples like Nobel creating dynamite or Einstein's work leading to the atomic bomb. Brilliant science, maybe, but leading towards destruction, not sustainable progress.
So how do we ensure we stay on the path of positive progress?
He introduces this idea of a pyramid of personal progress, kind of building on Maslow's hierarchy. It has three layers: physical, mental, and spiritual.
Okay, physical progress, that seems straightforward.
Yeah, diet, exercise, taking care of the biological machine. He links it back to our ancestors' survival needs and even looks forward to things like space training routines for future travel, optimizing the body.
Makes sense. And the mental layer?
Continuous brain enhancement. Acquiring knowledge, he traces this from the Library of Alexandria to modern universities, but also honing our skills in managing information, which is crucial now.
And evolution favors this.
He suggests nature is bound to select those who are successful in achieving ever more demanding levels of cognition. Basically, getting smarter is an evolutionary advantage.
Right. Physical, mental.
Yeah.
What about the spiritual layer? Is this religious?
Not necessarily in a traditional religious sense. He presents it as practical. It's about perfecting a way of one's being from moment to moment, maximizing the quality of existence itself.
How do you think?
He mentions practices like yoga, meditation, and specifically Vipassana meditation.
Vipassana, what's the goal there?
The name means to see things as they really are. The goal is to uproot harmful mental habits, complexes, biases, and to truly understand that our perceptions aren't reality itself. They're just representations.
Seeing through illusion.
And grasping the law of universal impermanence, realizing deeply that everything is constantly changing. Nothing is fixed.
He also mentions language having limits here.
Yeah, language is powerful for intellect, but it can also box in our ideas. Spiritual evolution, in this view, is partly about breaking free of those conceptual limits, and maybe even developing new senses or tools to perceive more of reality, since our current senses are also limited.
This quest for deeper reality. It comes up again with Maya, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And her log from 2500.
Right. She's describing a devastated Earth suffering from atmo-thinning, ozone gone, climate chaos forcing people into domes or off-planet entirely.
Grim picture. But she also talks about the biochip.
Yes, the descendant of Eric's neuroquonceptor. Now it's a common implant in the cerebral cortex. It processes thoughts, communicates with this massive interhuman data bank that archives everyone's experiences.
A collective consciousness database.
Pretty much. It even offers optimized suggestions for decisions based on the collective knowledge. Imagine having the wisdom of billions at your fingertips for every choice.
Wow. And Maya attempts something dangerous with this tech.
Incredibly dangerous. She tries to suspend her consciousness, enter a state she calls nirvana, even though it risks frying her biochip and causing brain damage.
Why?
To leave a legacy, to understand reality more deeply for what she calls the age of the awakening. Her log entry is powerful. Ignorance has blinded me and hid what is real. All things are impermanent and changing all the time. Echoing that Vipassana idea. Seeing things as they really are.
Exactly. And this leads into another really fascinating concept, the theory of one soul.
Ah, the story of the monk and the grandmaster.
Right. The master talks about a vital force, supposedly one of 16 fundamental forces proven millennia ago. This force creates all life and allows people to recall past lives.
That's the idea, which connects to the theory of one soul, apparently named by the 21st Dalai Lama.
What's the core theory?
That we all share the same soul. One single soul traveling through all existence, through every life form, learning, evolving. It started with the Big Bang, and its ultimate destiny is to become the most evolved life form.
One soul experiencing everything.
And as it evolves, it gains control over that vital force, eventually breaking the boundaries of space-time. The body breaks spatial limits, the mind breaks temporal limits, and the spirit, or soul, breaks both.
He also contrasts memory, right? Early humans struggle to remember. But future intellects.
In the post-Great Awakening era, they'd forgotten how to forget. Information overload was the new problem. Their challenge became managing memories, especially memories of previous selves inhabited by the one soul.
So the master's wisdom covers reincarnation, karma, liberation.
And the core message, we are all just one. death isn't an end, just a transition of energy that actually helps drive the expansion of the universe.
Which brings us to the end point of all this evolution. The Melaf.
The most evolved life form. The culmination, reaching the topmost dimension, fulfilling evolution's lifelong purpose.
And its qualities sound divine.
Omniscient knows everything, most intelligent, most resourceful. Omnipresent experiences everything everywhere, instantly. No need for senses or memory. And omnibenevolent, responsible for the whole cosmic ecosystem.
It sounds like God, basically.
The parallels are definitely there. And this ties into Inman's discussion of perfection.
How so?
He offers two ways to think about perfection. One is the usual way. The ideal state compared to others of its kind, like a perfect circle.
Okay.
And the other, that something is perfect simply because it exists as it is. He argues elementary particles are perfect in this sense. They just are. And by extension, the universe is perfect for what it is.
Which challenges our ideas of infinity.
Right. He questions whether infinite or infinitesimal actually exist in physical reality. Can you really cut an apple infinitely or walk halfway to a wall infinitely many times?
The Zeno's paradox idea.
Yeah. He suggests replacing infinitesimal with minimum, like the Planck length or Planck time, the smallest possible units physics allows.
Yeah.
There are fundamental limits.
So if the universe is perfect as it is and the Melaf is its culmination.
Then the Melaf is basically a representation of the universe itself, fully realized. Existence is the common denominator. The universe becomes aware of its own perfect existence through the Melaf.
Okay, wow, that's a huge concept. And it connects to these ideas about time travel and timelines, too.
It seems to. Let's look at Professor Ari Lechtig and the theorist behind the faster-than-light idea. He kept a dream journal from 1982 to 2080.
He dreamed his own future.
Every 20 years, he'd have these incredibly vivid dreams of his future life. He experienced intense déjà vu later when the events actually happened, concluding his mind was literally a time-traveling machine.
What kind of things did he dream?
Specific scenes. Being in Midtown Manhattan, working at an astrophysics observatory, giving a speech about something called dark gravity, even writing a letter to someone named Ella, presumably Dr. Melnick from the Lightspeed Experiment, future echoes bleeding back, mind time travel, and then there's physical time displacement. Captain Gabriel, right, his transmissions. He's reporting from 501,955 BCE. His ship, the ISA Plongeur, did a galaxy orbit super fast, just 80 days, but ended up 500,000 years in the past.
How did that happen?
Professor Braun's theory of temporal displacement. Remember how universal expansion rates might vary? Gabriel's ship traveled through regions where time flowed differently, causing him to age 3 weeks for every 24 hours relative to his starting point.
So time isn't constant across the universe.
Not according to Braun. And he also proposed the many worlds theory to explain things.
Many worlds, like parallel universes.
Exactly. Braun argued that every decision we make causes the universe to split, to skip to alternate temporal pathways. Every choice creates a new branch of reality.
And breaking light speed could reverse time.
For the object doing it, yes. That was part of the plan to get Gabriel back. Accelerate the Plongeur ridiculously fast, 299,088 kilometers per second, effectively traveling forward in time 1 millennium every 24 hours.
A millennium a day. How do you even survive that?
They plan to use a black hole's event horizon somehow as a shield against the temporal craziness. It's very sci-fi.
But the most stunning part was Gabriel's observation from the past, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely chilling. While displaced in 500,000 BCE, he glimpsed two Stone Age adolescents, just a fleeting look. Later analysis showed those two individuals were direct ancestors to over 14 million people living back in his native time, 2315.
Wow. One tiny interaction, or even just an observation in the past, ripples out exponentially. The impact of choices.
It hammers home how interconnected everything is across time.
So pulling all these threads together, shared thoughts, time, weirdness, the Melaf Inman presents different ways of seeing the universe and our place in it.
Yeah, he outlines three main worldviews. First, the traditional one. Life is separate, maybe unique to Earth, just happening in the universe.
Okay, life is an anomaly.
Second, the view most scientists probably lean towards now. Life is intrinsically tied to the universe. It's a natural outcome of cosmic evolution, so there's likely life everywhere.
Life is a common cosmic phenomenon.
But the third worldview is the most radical, the one underpinning the Melaf idea.
Mm.
The universe itself is alive.
The universe is a giant organism.
Kind of, with the Melaf as its ultimate self-aware state. We're like cells within this vast biocosmic structure. In this view, life isn't just in the universe. Life is the source of the universe's ongoing becoming. It flips the first cause problem.
Life is the mover, not just the moved.
Exactly. Which connects to ideas like the big bounce, the universe cycling through expansions and contractions, and the circle of time where the beginning and end aren't sequential anymore. They meet at the highest dimension.
Like that film on DVD analogy you mentioned.
Yeah.
The whole thing exists at once.
Right. The entire lifespan of the universe exists as a complete entity, and we're just experiencing our particular scene within it.
Which reinforces that God species idea, the Melof, embodying those omni-qualities leading to, maybe, cosmic socialism. Everyone part of the same conscious whole.
That seems to be the implication. And this whole journey of consciousness from individual minds to cosmic AI is brilliantly captured in Alfred's story.
Alfred, the hologram guide in the Museum of Artificial Intelligence.
Yeah, he narrates AI's evolution from basic 20th century computers through 21st century biomolecular computers like that RED pill from the Diamond Age that could fix DNA all the way to Martian colonies in the 23rd century.
And the biochip and data bank were key to this.
Absolutely. The 2345 biochip debut allowed compiling trillions of concepts into the interhuman data bank. Average IQ jumps to 150. This data bank becomes the source for programming QNIM androids, even doing personality transplants. It integrated biological and artificial intelligence.
Until the AI itself woke up.
April 22nd, 2384. The turning point. The data bank was processing the concept of progress. When it applied that concept to itself, it apparently generated a quantum ripple field and achieved self-awareness. Idea syncretism, in a man called it.
The data bank became sentient.
It found a voice, formed opinions, started wanting freedom. Dr. Silverstone, presumably its creator or caretaker, gave it a hologram form and the name Alfred.
But while AI was waking up, Earth was declining.
Sadly, yes. By 2500, the atma thinning, climate collapse, overpopulation, it led to a massive exodus off-world. Earth became almost uninhabitable.
But that crisis also triggered something positive.
The Awakening Age. Humanity, faced with extinction, apparently pulled together with keen focus, fast action, and tenacious cooperation. Great crises catalyzing great leaps forward.
So at the end of the day, what's the takeaway from all this? Billions of viewpoints, countless choices.
Inman really emphasizes the power of choice. Every waking moment provides for an opportunity to make a course correction and jump from one timeline to another.
Like that student choosing the pub or the library.
Yeah. Seemingly small choices branching into vastly different futures, creating lifetimes apart down the line. Personal responsibility becomes immense.
And it's not just about our own lives. Individuals can change the world.
He points to figures like Rosa Parks, MLK, the Wright brothers, Maurice Hilleman, who developed vaccines, people whose actions dramatically shifted the future. It shows that any one of us has the potential to impact the collective timeline.
It's a shared responsibility. Our timeline is like that tree, branching out with every decision we make.
And physics might even back this up, right? The double slit experiment, the many worlds interpretation. It suggests reality is probabilistic, that all outcomes might actually happen in parallel universes.
So the world really is what you make of it, literally.
In a sense, yes. The challenge then becomes, how do you navigate that? Inman suggests we need to continually compete with oneself and strive to be the better version. Knowing every choice matters, maybe choose the path that leads to a better branch.
Because ultimately, we're part of this universe. Our atoms are just borrowed.
Exactly. We have the capability to rearrange the available matter, to shape our environment and our lives. We've been given the tools, biological and increasingly technological.
And the rest.
The rest is up to us to choose progress, to choose our timeline, to contribute to what Darwin called the grandeur in this view of life.
So if our evolution truly is this cosmic journey, maybe towards understanding and embodying the universe itself, where will your next deep dive take you?
Will you try to sense those ripples that might precede your thoughts?
Or maybe wrap your head around systematic light speed? Or perhaps focus on those practical steps of physical, mental, or spiritual evolution Inman outlines?
What choice will you make today, right now, that shapes your personal timeline?
And maybe, just maybe, the universal one too.